Don't say I didn't warn you.
I have come here to kick bubblegum and chew ass. And I'm all out of ass.
Say, what are you trying to
do? My bowling ball's frozen in a footlocker in Chicago.
Brain rot.
I say that because he is Bigfoot.
Soratagamo.
Maybe I should just fucking quit. Don't fucking quit. I don't know what the fuck I'm supposed to fucking do.
Brain lock, damn it. A picture of Mary.
Who would win a fight between Mamie Eisenhower and Billy Graham?
President.
How about Bo Diddley and Kay Smith?
What's the relationship between Styrofoam and the planet Jupiter?
Don't say I didn't warn you.
No! This is We Talk Games Arcade Weekly Spooktacular!
Oh!
There we go. Some spooky howling, some pretzel eating happening in the background. Yeah, we are an arcade review show brought to you each Monday free of charge from your friends over at WeTalkGames.com. And oh boy, it is a full cast. I'm your host, Kyle Von Kubik, and I'm joined along with Chris Necobun.
Boo.
Keith the Robo Duke.
Ahoy!
And John E. Capcom.
Hey.
And this week we're talking about Pumpkinhead, limited release October 14th, 1988. That's specific. By developer Stan Winston.
The Ghostbuster?
Published by United Artists. What the? Oh, this is a film. We're reviewing a film today.
You mean I didn't play a video game starring Lance Henriksen?
That's why it was so easy to beat.
I get. You know what? I thought it was one of those Laserdisc games like Dragon's Lair, only I never saw the screen flash. Actually, the screen did flash quite a number of times.
That's right, mortal fools. Friends. I am Count Flagula, on account I like flags. And this is my trusty manservant, the deaf-mute robot caveman, Ugor! Ugor, go get me a Fresca. Since this is the 8-Bit Horror Fest, I am your 8-Bit Horror host, Count Flagula! On account I like flags. Today's movie is Pumpkinhead. I remember in 1988 being a horror movie fanatic, and there were two magazines that you would really delve into. One was Famous Monsters, and the other one was Fangoria. Fangoria was more of the gore and guts, and I think it's probably still a magazine on the racks today. And it dealt more with hack and slash type of movies, and of course, special effects. I was more into Famous Monsters magazine than I was into the Fangoria. In 1988, you had movies like Hobgoblin and Cheerleader Camp and Killer Clowns from Outer Space and Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers, Monkey Shines, Phantasm 2, and I don't know what chapter of Jason and Voorhees. And Toxic Avenger was on every shelf in the VHS and Betamax rental stores. Did they have records at that time with movies? Where's my Fresca? But those franchises attracted the casual horror moviegoers. Well, maybe not Toxic Avenger. I'm not really sure who that appealed to, except demented minds like mine. And Ugor's. But if you were a horror movie fanatic in the late 80s, there were pretty much two standouts. One was the Hellraiser series and Pinhead, which was incredibly boring to me. But the character was awesome. Maybe I should have said three, because you also had Evil Dead. But Evil Dead would make some sort of a jump over, a crossover, especially since it became an off-Broadway hit, at least getting hit with blood, like a Gallagher show, and also a new awesome television series. And then there was Pumpkinhead. Pumpkinhead, to me, was unique because in an age of hack and slash and gore and this and that and the other, was this very cool monster, and he was a giant. And to me, all the shots of the creature harkened back to the three-shot of Frankenstein's monster reveal, or the strip light on Bela Lugosi's eyeballs. It might not have had the budget that the other popular slasher movies had at the time, well, except Toxic Avenger, once again. But it had something special, and it didn't need to rely on gore. The shots of the unrelenting, tireless Pumpkinhead, or perhaps he should have been called Gourdhead, were enough to make Pumpkinhead a beloved monster among the late 1980s horror fans. And in fact, enough to spawn three sequels. Let us now return to the crew of We Talk Games. Let's see if the boys get it right. I am Count Flagula. On account I like flags. It's now time for me to return to my coffin and listen offline to the review of Pumpkinhead.
Yeah, it's your friends from We Talk Games here for another 8-Bit Horror Fest, everybody. We've been subcontracted out to another podcast because Stinky the Game Master does this stuff to us.
He takes all the money.
But we're happy to be here and to be a part of 8-Bit Horror Fest, and we'll be reviewing Pumpkinhead, the 1988 film, which did have a limited release then, but I believe it had a wide release in 1989. It is the origin film of the well-regarded Pumpkinhead series.
I didn't know it had sequels.
I knew there was a second one, but I didn't realize it got up to, there's like four? Five?
I didn't realize it had a fucking video game.
Yeah, this is 8-Bit Horror Fest Origins, where all the reviews this year are based around the beginning of well-known, long-lasting horror series like Pumpkinhead, a.k.a. Fleshy Alien.
You want to be careful there, Keith, because a lot of shitty series of horror movies generally tend to have the origins in like the 7th or 8th entry.
Yes, this is true.
Yeah, I guess this isn't the origin of Pumpkinhead, but it certainly is a part of the old wives' tale. It's the first one, but who even still knows what Pumpkinhead is by the end of this movie? Because I really don't know.
I think this was a movie that they were sitting around and they're like, we got the rights to this poem, I guess, about this Pumpkinhead monster, and they're like, let's make a movie about it. And then they mocked up the monster and they're like, this looks like fucking Jack Pumpkinhead from Return to Oz. Let's make it look like a xenomorph instead, because those are much more popular.
To be fair, one of the special effects guys and the guy in the suit had worked on Aliens,
really?
No, yeah. Tom Woodruff Jr., yeah, the guy in the suit. He was the lead alien in Alien 3, one of the other aliens. He also worked on stuff for Demolition Man, Death Becomes Her. He's been around. Basically, guys who were or turned into Stan Winston Creature Shop core crew, so.
Yeah, and don't be mistaken. The creature or the monster in this film and the practical effects in this film are fucking amazing. They're very good.
They recycle a lot of elements from Alien, including Lance Henriksen himself. Or aliens. Stan Winston obviously didn't create the alien monster. That would have been H.R. Geiger and the team on the Ridley Scott aliens. But Stan Winston was brought in to make the Alien Queen and a bunch of other things for the sequel, and he seems to just kind of went, you know what? If I pop a new head on this monster here, and if Lance isn't doing anything next week, we could probably get a thing done here. Like,
the film does seem very slapped together. I'll agree with you. My wife and I watched this together for the very first time, and I said, I don't know if there was so much a script for this film as there was an outline. And I wasn't saying that to try to be funny. I really feel that way because it's very disjointed. Even so much so with the titular character. They call him Pumpkinhead, but then they don't address him as Pumpkinhead. And then where is he? He's in a graveyard, but there's pumpkins in the graveyard for some reason. And then later on, we're talking about a pumpkin patch graveyard. It's very confused.
I didn't think it was that bad, like, plot-wise. It's just the first section. Okay, I really love, like, the introductory bit. And then when the bit with the kids and, like, all the establishing shots with it. Lance and his kid. I guess we'll get to that in a minute.
No, let's. Chris, why don't you just take it from here? Let's just hash through the movie from beginning to end. Spoiler alerts. And as you go through it, we'll interject with our feelings about how the story is progressing. So please start.
So, Pumpkinhead, the movie. The first. Kind of a cold open with this family in this cabin. Things are dark. Things are weird. They're all sitting around the fire.
1957 for some reason.
Yes, one kid does his prayers and totally does not include his dad. guy with a shotgun. I forget the actor's name, but he's one of those bald and beard faces you see. Yeah. Classic old farm dude walking around with a shotgun. Something's going down outside. Puts a horse.
It's a dark and stormy night.
Yeah, and while they're waiting, some other guy comes bolting through the woods like freaking Rutger Hauer light. Bags on the door. It's like, let me in, baby, baby. I didn't kill that woman, blah, blah, blah. Or my daughter, whatever. What the heck was going on? But, yeah, basically he's getting chased by some.
I did not hit her. I did not.
Yeah.
No, that's a different film.
The acting's about on par, to be honest. Not going to lie, Lance really flat in a lot of places in this movie. But anyway, knocks on the door. They won't let him in. And then our monster, you get two quick glimpses of him, and then dead. And we go to present day.
Real quick, I just want to touch on, for me, this was a dumb moment in the film right off the bat. I'd be fine with this 1957, dark, stormy night, guy banging on the door. Don't show us, even if it's a silhouette, don't show us the fucking monster, not even 3 minutes into the film. Save that shit. And I'll describe why later, because I feel like with my very limited ability in screenwriting, I took two courses in college. I feel like I could have wrote a better Pumpkinhead script using exactly all the same things that they already had in this film. Do not show the monster the first three. And that's when I was like, oh, it's a fucking xenomorph, because the silhouette of this thing looks like a fucking xenomorph.
It looks like a xenomorph. I do agree with you as well, Kyle. This is a total flub on their part by showing the monster, but it is a classic 80s horror opening. They're establishing everything you get. They should have kept the quick looks of the monster. There's like real quick flashes of the monster's face, and you could have kept that in there, but the full body shot of the monster holding the guy where,
dumb.
You know, 10 seconds earlier, the dad's like, you, honey, keep the kid in the bed. And then all of a sudden, the kid's at the window?
Yeah.
Like looking out like, oh, what's going on? Like, weren't you just controlling the kid a second ago? And that definitely screws everything up. But then we get to go to modern day Lance Henriksen.
I would assume that this was the filmmakers going 101, thinking, we need to do something at the beginning to keep people interested, because for the next 20 minutes, it's going to be a lot of talking.
Yeah, and that's fine. But I would have appreciated seeing the guy screaming and maybe quick jump cuts of him being slashed up or something. This monster is very vindictive, too. We'll talk about some of the kills later. I would have added the scene of this guy the next day being, like, torn to shreds or something, and then the little town coming around him, if we're going to go with this, I guess, Appalachian hillbilly type of motif. So it's left to the imagination. Was this a revenge killing, or was this actually a monster? Because I think you could have played with that theme throughout the film.
Yeah, I feel like they should have, like, one or two quick glimpses, like, show the tail. It had a tail, I believe, or something. Or one claw, that would have been plenty. But, it lingered a little too long. I didn't think it was that bad. And I think the part of that point was to establish that it was a monster and not a revenge killing.
Right.
I'm not sure how the marketing was for this, if it was, like, on the posters or anything at that point. So, like, if you went in already knowing, I could see it kind of being like but standard filming practices, definitely a botched call there.
But after this botched opening, we get some really great scenes of shirtless Lance Henriksen doing farm work with his son that looks like you could do one of those alternate movie trailers where you could take all these scenes and make it look like it's a movie about a father and son roughing it, trying to make it after their wife died. You know, you could totally make this look like a different movie. If you came in on this part, you might think you're watching something else entirely.
Their wife? Was the kid married to the mom too?
Oh, wife and mom. Sorry. Sorry, guys. I got problems. Freudian slip. Oops.
Well, I mean, it is like, what, the Appalachian backcountry. So, I mean, who knows? It could
have been. Okay, true. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I meant. I was making fun of hill people.
Yeah. You know what? When my wife and I were watching this, having a son.
Oh, I wanted to know this. I was going to ask if you cried.
No, I didn't, because of how poorly everything was executed with this family. We actually, I'll talk about
there's
some of the
no mention
later.
Of the mother, like not like a single mention of her.
I know. Did she get out of Dodge? Did she die? I think maybe there was an allusion to her being dead. Oh, yeah, there definitely was, because later on he goes to her gravestone and tells her what happened. But we'll get to that. Yeah, so a lot of people would assume that, oh, this father and son thing would ring so true to me, because when my son was born, my love for him, this new being who entered the world, like, is indescribable. But what coupled with that was my hatred for everyone else that exists on this planet. So you would think that this movie would somehow hit a note emotionally for me, and it didn't. It was very flat. I'm sorry to disappoint everybody.
Well, they didn't need to spend time on the mother, all right? Because they needed to be in the car with those kids talking about nothing for 15 minutes, okay?
But that's John, what people pay Joel's to see. A really good guy, actually.
He's got a sweet dick. I hear it. Like,
you
know.
You want to talk about the yuppies driving into the backwoods country?
Yeah, rebellious teenagers incoming. Watch out.
Okay, so there's this backwoods family. They run a general store and a farm, and there's the setup to that. And they're opening their general store for the day. There's supposed to be these emotional and loving moments between father and son. But now here comes the city kids into the backwoods, and they're douchebags. And now, please, have at it.
A cadre of six of them, I think. You've got Ben Cree from Sequest, DSV, some nobodies, young Clark Kent was in there. You got, what is it, Joel is Don DeAquino's the obligatory dickhead, yeah. Driving the fast car, yeah, and they're dragging around some dirt bikes, gonna go on vacation.
Hey, bitch, beer me.
Exactly. Yeah.
He's that character.
Yeah. And then his brother and
is it Steve?
His friend and their girlfriends are in the truck. It's all banter. They stop at the convenience store, and that's when we start getting the fully fleshed characters, like girl who is a photographer, guy who has sunglasses. There's young Clark Kent for you. Douchebag's brother and douchebag's brother's girlfriend. Exciting times right there.
I think one of the reasons Kyle didn't get emotionally upset by the father and son story is because ultimately he identifies more with the douchebags from the city, because Kyle obviously is a high-rolling New York City bad boy. And he don't care what these fucking rubes think.
Just buzzing hedges and knocking down toddlers with my dirt bike.
How else would you be known as Rad Kyle?
So, yeah, how would we describe these people? Fucking assholes roll up to this little country store, and they're looking to buy beer. Evidently, it's a dry store. There's no alcohol. And the douchebag, the real antagonist of the film, starts buzzing around his dirt bike, and the other people are there. And then these, I don't want to keep describing them as hillbillies, but they're hillbillies. They roll up. They're
the harbingers, though.
Please describe further.
It's a horror movie term, which I take from Cabin in the Woods, which, of course, is a look at all horror movies and their structure and turned into a film. But they are the people who you run into before the horror, like, don't go out there. You got to watch, you know, the little girls singing the Freddy song. You know, you get these country folk who taunt one of their siblings for stealing the ball from Ed Harley's son. Lance Hendrickson is Ed Harley.
I kept calling him Ed Hardy, though, throughout the entire film. Hardy. Just making funny, like, those stupid jeans with the fucking tigers on him and shit. But, yeah, it was handled very clunkily, though.
Yeah,
clunkily is not a word, but this movie is very clunkily as far as its structure. Because prior to this, with the douchebag kids, there is this scene where there's this hitchhiker,
carrying a rifle, walking down the road.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, clearly they don't pick him up. She's the one photographer is taking pictures of him or whatever. There's no payoff to that. That could have been some sort of key to this plot, or he could have been the I don't know, the order or the
like he's the Chekhov's gun. Like you see him, he has a gun. He should show up later.
Yeah, like he's some sort of oracle or something to say, like, you know, doom and gloom's about to happen.
But that's why they make them the little kids, the harbingers. That's what I mean. Like, that's the same term, oracle. But instead they make it the little kids who then even tie back into the story later. So it kind of works, except for the fact that these are supposed to be people who live up in the hills. And that one girl has a really nice perm.
Yeah. Hitchhiker McRifleson should have been the guy who showed up later with the dog, but I'm pretty sure those were completely different actors.
They were.
Yeah.
There
also,
was a dog later. I got lost later in this movie.
The second youngest daughter, also familiar face there. I had to go look this up eventually, but Maya Bialik, Blossom.
What?
Like, yeah, look at her face and you'll be like, oh shit.
Oh, that was Maya Bialik. Damn.
So this hillbilly family rolls up. The kids are playing outside. The dad's looking for feed. The dad of the young child, Ed Hardy, forgot to bring the feed. So he has to go back and get it for hillbilly dad. While this exchange is happening, shitty kids are being shitty. Outside, the little hillbilly kids steal
some of the
young...
kids are trying to be nice. Like, I think only, like, Joel's being a dick. This is all Joel's fault. He's being a prick. He wants to turn around
on the dirt
bike.
He makes fun of the little kid with his glasses. He's like, oh, it looks like fucking Coke bottles.
It's worse than Coke bottles. And meanwhile, like,
up your nose with the rubber hose.
Yeah, everyone else is being nice to these kids, but I also think they're trying to make the point that they are tourists, and they are looking at them like a spectacle, you know, where the lady's like, oh, it's a camera. Can I take your picture? Would that be okay? You know, like, they're just there to gawk at them.
Yeah. So the pig pen children steal the little boy's ball, which leads to them singing this poem, which is credited in the opening of the film, that this whole film is based on this little poem about Pumpkinhead and how when you're bad, Pumpkinhead comes after you.
He's a Krampus.
Pretty much, yeah. And then the kid starts to cry. The city teenagers are like, oh my gosh, it's terrible. Don't make her cry. And that's it. They leave. The hillbilly children and their father leave. And now Ed Hardy has to go back home and get the feed and leaves his son to attend the general store. Bad parenting. Nobody's coming to your fucking store, dude. Just lock up for the 10 minutes you're going to be gone and go get the fucking feed. What's wrong with you?
Same thing I thought.
Right. Just, so what happens next, Chris?
Well, the kid's sitting in the store with his dog, Gypsy, who you actually may recognize from the film Gremlins. It's the same dog.
Get out of here, man.
Nope.
Man, his name is, with the all dog, the facts. Damn.
The dog's name is Mushroom, and put in one of the finest performances.
No, please, I'm sorry.
That's so good.
I'm not
good.
Kidding. His name's Mushroom.
Stop saying it.
That's the best name for a dog I've ever heard. I
Stop
love it.
Stop saying what? Mushroom?
Mushroom. Oh, my God. That's ridiculous. Who names their dog Mushroom?
Well, apparently one who knows their pup is destined for stardom.
Yeah, I guess.
At least two movies under Mushroom's belt.
All right, so what happens to Mushroom in this film?
Well, Gypsy, as Mushroom is going by in this, bolts out the door like a dickhead to bark at the other dickhead, the bike dickhead, chief bike dickhead, not
Joel.
Brother dickhead, who's also on a bike at this point, because they're like daring each other to do stuff between all the stock stuntman motocross footage, because it's the 80s and we need that.
That's where we learn Joel is, I think Steve is the other guy with the headband's brother. Where,
yes,
you know,
he straight up says, who's my brother?
I think Chris is the other guy, and he's like, come on, man, why you got to do this? And all he says is, he's my brother. And then just puts his helmet on and rides off.
Great
reason to do anything. He stabbed a guy. He's my brother.
Chris is young Clark Kent. I mean that, like, the actor played young Clark Kent in one of the Superman movies.
Oh, and his real name is Mushroom.
Well, he's got similar hair. They might be brothers. So the dickheads are biking around. Kid chases the dog out. Of course, something's going to go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
And by horribly wrong, the kid basically Steve's
shit into the tire of the dirt bike.
Yeah, Steve's motorbike misses him, and then Joel's motorbike does less missing of his face.
Right.
Although
the film totally
misses in the shot. Like, they tried to shoot around it, but it does not, it's not the most convincing impact. I was into the commentary, I actually watched this twice, and apparently they had a dummy that they were gonna like throw into the bike, but they thought that was gonna be a little too much. But yeah, douchebag and brother of douchebag wipe out, kid is wiped out, everybody's freaking out, and eventually daddy land shows back up and is very pissed. Oh well, that before that, all the other kids peace out, like,
Well, Joel takes off immediately because evidently he's out on parole
and he's had one beer and he thinks that's gonna end his life.
So
he was a tall boy and maybe he has a shitty tolerance, I don't know,
but they're in the middle of nowhere. Come on, man, you'll sober up by the time the cops get
here. He thinks he killed the kid. The movie doesn't do a good job letting the audience know whether this kid is actually dead, because he's blinking in a lot of shots.
Well, no,
or if he's paralyzed, or if he's fading out. Yeah.
He's supposed to be still alive. Basically, Steve, the brother, hangs out after him.
Right, because the teens run into the general store to call an ambulance, who didn't bail, and there's no phone in this fucking store. Because good parent.
They head up to the cabin to find a phone. This is pre-cell phones, by the way, 1988.
Yes. So that helps the plot a little bit, that technology is limited.
Yeah.
So pretty much everybody but Steve hangs back with this kid, and they all leave for the cabin. Joel to escape or run away, and the other teens to go and you know, call for help. Finally, yes, Ed Hardy arrives in his stupid hat and stupid jeans, and he's clearly fucking angry and pissed. Grabs his son, brings his son back to the cabin, and then, oh, okay, now he's dead. I still think he's blinking in a lot of shots, too, where he's now dead, but whatever.
Yeah, that's why they swapped him out for the dummy in the truck. I'm serious. The under the blanket, the kid is a dummy.
And back at the cabin, we find out that Joel has been beating up his girlfriend and some other girl that's with them, who's Steve's girlfriend, I believe.
They say beat him up?
Well, she's got like a red mark under her eye, and she's all like cowering and whatnot.
Oh, the one
and
sitting definitely on the couch, she's like freaked out.
He definitely
out.
Does. Joel shoves his girlfriend to the ground when she's trying to calm him down.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the other lady, he's like.
Yeah, Maggie was free. Maggie, jean jacket girl, Steve's girlfriend, was already freaking out just from the impact because apparently Jesus doesn't prepare you for any sort of trauma whatsoever.
This is something I think the movie does okay, is plays with the people's perceptions, you know, like Ed Harley's just reacting badly to what was an accident all in the end. And all these other kids are trying to do the right thing, but Joel's not letting them do the right thing. So they all have to get dragged down with him.
Exactly. And this is where I feel like the film could have taken the opportunity of playing with the audience. Is the killer Joel? Because it comes to a certain point where Joel is now locking up friends in closets because he doesn't want anyone to say anything. He cuts the cord on the telephone so people don't call the police because he doesn't want to get in trouble. He just wants to run and hide. And his friends obviously are pushing back, which creates this conflict. I thought that this conflict could have been built upon to lead the audience to believe, not in this film, but in a rewrite of this film, that maybe Joel's the killer, or maybe Ed Harley is the killer because now he's seeking revenge on these kids for killing his son, because he perceives that these kids killed his son and just ran off, with the exception of one, which, again, doesn't really make a lot of sense. Why would one stay behind if they weren't trying to go for help, especially because your bullshit store doesn't have a fucking telephone? I'm sorry, it's still the 80s. You should have had a telephone in your store.
You should have had a Newton. He could have just fucking emailed that shit, but no. Or at least a pager.
So they don't do that in this film. They don't have pagers, they don't have a Newton, and they don't build suspense in that respect. Instead, Ed Harley drops off the feed with his dead son in the car to the hillbilly village. And he's asking the father that he's dropping the feed off to about this witch that he knows about who has magical powers. Let's pick up from here, Chris.
Well, I actually just wanted to point out that they didn't have time to do any of this building suspense regarding the killer, since they wasted time wanking off with these kids for like half a goddamn hour.
Absolutely. I agree with John when he criticized that. It was too much of this bullshit with these fucking essentially meat for the grinder in this film.
Basically, once it gets dark is when things finally focus in. It's like, monster suit time, let's party.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So the father, Ed Harley, goes, meets with the witch, tells her what happened.
Haggis.
Pretty much haggis, yeah. Makes a deal with the devil, essentially, to summon this creature to exact revenge. Now, again, in my rewrite of this film, I would have it more of a second guess as if this monster is real or not, or if he's just zooted up on hillbilly moonshine and killing these teens.
But I never thought of that. That would have been really good, though. If you did that, we would not have any of these scenes with this witch Haggis, which her house reminds me a lot of Resident Evil 7, a certain level in, where you have to take on a crazy old witch lady, a lot like her, with a cabin full of bugs. So I did like being reminded of that in the scenes, and her makeup's really good. She almost just looks... She looks like any deadite old lady in like Evil Dead 1, 2, or Army of Darkness. You know, I'll swallow your soul. She looks like that, but she's way more chill.
I surely would have liked comparisons positively with Evil Dead, because they did kind of rip off its central plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like, well, you're going to be kind of chill as an evil old lady if one of your previous credits was vasectomy, a touchy subject. But I'm serious. Again, I looked up pretty much everybody in this after I watched it. And she's done some other character work, but that one really stood out to me. I'm going to have to track that one down. I wonder if it's on Netflix.
I'm wondering if she must return in the sequels, you know, because she's part of the lore of Pumpkinhead, I'm assuming.
I would say at least as flashbacks. I mean, well, we'll get to the ending eventually.
Let's talk about the making mechanics of Pumpkinhead and what's involved. So this is what you have to do to invoke Pumpkinhead. You have to go meet this witch. She slashes your hand, right? Oh, no.
Slash was one of the best parts because you could, well, you can, first you got to go get the Pumpkinhead from the graveyard. Then right. She slashes your hand, and somebody has a poorly hidden hose dripping fake blood behind the knife because it's dropping half an inch away from your hand.
Yeah.
Leave the boy with me.
You got to drop off a dead child's body and watch the owl in the background. Like, I guess the handler was messing with it to keep its head spinning, but there's a couple shots where it's just looking off the side, just doing the little owl head bop thing, just having a great old time.
No, that owl was cute. That's a cute owl. That's not a spooky owl. I like that owl. another missed opportunity for me, and another different sort of direction they could have went with. I thought what was going to summon Pumpkinhead was the little boy's body. I thought that was the mechanic of how you would summon Pumpkinhead. You bury the body in this pumpkin patch, and then this fucking demon comes out and exacts revenge. Think like Jason Voorhees. And I also thought about Friday the 13th, where it's like, oh, is the big reveal at the end, it's going to be just an imagination type thing. And then I realized at a certain point it's not. But like that, it is just Ed Harley. It's not a monster. No, it's very much a monster that you have to dig up in this graveyard that has pumpkins for some reason, because fuck, it's Halloween, and bring back. And then, yes, there's some bloodletting happening with a very bad phony blood knife.
I just want to pause here. The expository shot of the graveyard, like the first two where he's walking through the arch with the skeletal hand dragging them, that stuff was lame as hell. But when it cuts to the side view and it just kind of pans up and around the mound that Pumpkinhead is buried in, that is one of the best shots in the goddamn movie.
There's even a really nice moment where it's real quiet as Ed Harley's walking up to it, and then he puts the shovel in the ground and the music hits at the same time, and it's super foggy and spooky. Yeah, besides being a little too evident that a lot of those shots are indoor sets, they look really nice.
Yeah. I like those sets. I thought those sets looked good.
They're some of the best parts of the movie are the indoor sets, actually. The outdoor stuff is, you know, back roads, woods, and things like that. I like the building town, speaking of those sets as well. Just
That was
the
look good set it. As well. A lot of use of the blue filter on the camera because we're trying to convey night, but we're shooting in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Which is like, I fucking hate that shit so much. It rings very cheap, but I mean, I'm not a huge horror fan, but I think that just happened a lot in the 80s, because I remember a lot of 80s horror films using that method to have their night shots, you know?
Yeah. Day for night is what it's called. It was pretty common practice for a long time. And, big films that people would know, like Deliverance, uses Day for Night. Just does it well.
Right.
There's a great dichotomy with the lighting. Like, all the human scenes at night, like in the house, everything's always red, whereas Pumpkinhead is always kind of blue and otherworldly. And again, according to the commentary, the blue lighting and all like the strobing and stuff, that was completely intentional. That's not just dramatic effect. That is supposed to be some sort of like psychic turbulence that follows Pumpkinhead. For reasons.
Yeah, so when your blood is let to Pumpkinhead, you are like psychically connected to it while it exacts revenge, and it starts exacting revenge on the teens in the cabin, and of course it goes after the more innocent victims first before it goes after the person who actually did the deed.
Well, they were dumb enough to go outside, so they're gonna get it no matter what.
Yeah, Pumpkinhead, not afraid of the Jesus piece, we find out.
Oh, yeah. They kind of set up after. Okay, so there's a bit of a woodsy bit, and Pumpkinhead gets Steve, the brother. Granted, that was the first one that Ed Hardy saw when he was getting the kid's body, so that kind of makes sense. You know, the blind vengeance at that point. He sees the guy who he assumes is, knows is the most responsible for killing his son at that point. He's the first one to go. His girlfriend runs back after, like, talking about how, like, trying to bring her back to her senses by waving her cross necklace in her face. And then there's a little scene back at the cabin where she's just like, only God can stop this thing or whatever, because, you know, she saw it directly. Then another great shot here, it cuts over to camera girl, Tracy, I think, going through the drawers and pulling out, like, she's like looking at a cleaver and a chef's knife, so, like, just in case God doesn't show up. But as it pans across, it's the first full body reveal of the monster just zipping past the window, and it's beautiful. It still feels a little too early for it, but it works.
At this point, I'd be fine with the reveal, but he does still very much look like a xenomorph with a different head.
Totally.
And I'm totally cool with it. Poem aside, why is this thing called Pumpkinhead?
Apparently, it's tied to the pumpkin patch, but they don't really explain that well, at least not in this one.
Well, what they could have done is, you know, if you release this movie 15 years later during the gritty reboot age...
Which they're trying to do.
Yeah, well, this is already gritty, but I'm saying just... You could have done the same plot later, but just call it The Great Pumpkin.
What?
I think that's been used.
Probably.
Yeah. One of the working titles was actually Vengeance Demon, which I think would have been a lot worse. But
that's way on the nose.
Yeah, that was before they got the poem to lock it in and then get actual creature designs done. Shout out to the... Oh, we didn't talk about the baby pumpkin head puppet as they're summoning it. That was love that. It was so cute, and yet just puppets. Weird enough.
Yeah.
So then the kills start, which there are, as you mentioned earlier, Kyle, Pumpkinhead is quite malicious and just seems to enjoy just carving. Oh, yeah, he like maliciously carves the cross into the one girl's face. There's a scene in the crumbled house where he picks up a piece of wood that looks like a crucifix and smashes it. This movie goes for shock value by attacking religion.
Pumpkinhead's all like, I ain't afraid of no Christ.
What does Haggis say to Lance Henriksen when he says, he's like, God damn you, or God damn me, and she's like, he already has, or something like that.
You fool.
Yeah.
You pumpkin head.
Yeah, the whole burnout church, I think, that's when we're down to two and a half survivors. The one guy... wasn't really part of the problem, but we'll get to him.
The
whole cross smash thing. It's great because this kid leads these two there, saying, yeah, like, I don't know. I don't think he'll, like, I figure it's a holy place. And he just, like, Pumpkinhead hovers at the door for a minute when he finally shows up and then just starts walking through, like, what's up? What's up?
Yeah.
Jesus ain't here, man.
Yeah, because we did. Was it Lance Henriksen eventually regrets his choice? I think we need to mention that. He doesn't want this to keep happening because he can see all of it and knows at this point that Pumpkinhead is killing people who aren't responsible in the end for this accident.
Yeah.
And that he may have gone a little too far.
We're not on act three yet.
Oh, we're not there? Oh, man, we're just jumping on.
We're close. The other thing I liked, the Maggie, the cross girl, I kind of really loved Pumpkinhead comes back to the cabin to drop her off, the cabin from Halloween. Jason dies in Halloween 4, but I think it was in another Halloween. Again, a lot of familiar faces and places in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
When he drops Maggie's body off, he just kind of taps her against the window a couple times and then shoves her through.
Yes.
And it's just dropping blood all over the counter, but it's right next to the sink, so it was very thoughtful. Easy
he
cleanup. Just get
rubbing her face on the glass, and I was like, Pumpkinhead's a freak.
Yeah. Another thing I love, pretty much all of the deaths, apparently, I guess... they got a good deal on their wire harness because everybody gets a goddamn ride. Everybody's getting lifted up, and one girl he just hauls her straight up a goddamn tree and throws her out. Kim, the chief douchebag's girlfriend.
Oh yeah, right onto the rock, just breaking her back.
She got a proper Mongolian death, though. Right, John knows what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
Where the thing in a Mongolian culture is like seppuku, where the Japanese samurai kills himself for honor reasons. In Mongolian culture, bleeding is seen as undignified. So what they would do to honor people that needed to be killed in an honorific way was they would break their backs over logs or rocks. Ooh. And this happened to Genghis Khan's brother when he tried to overthrow him for the crown of the Mongolian Empire. I believe they broke his back over a log, not a rock. But when she dropped onto the rock, I'm like, well, at least in Mongolian culture, she got an honorable death.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of education and history lesson for all you listeners out there. If you're still listening after that, I apologize.
Pumpkinhead may have been better, I feel, because of people like Freddy and Chucky, because of those like malicious killers, they take this demon and make him like sneer and almost like wink at the fucking camera, like, I'm such a bad dude, ain't I? And it kind of ruins his intimidation factor, and all of a sudden you're like, you know what, you ain't too bad, dude, you know, at least you can crack a smile through all this killing.
What do you think, John, just with these kills?
They're not too bad. I'll be honest with you, they're quite tame in comparison to what
I felt the same way.
Other films of the time, which is surprising considering Stan Winston is a effects guy. I will say he's not one of my favorite effects guys. He's all right, but I mean, give me Rob Bottin any day of the week or Tom Savini, because they're more into the gore side of things, where there's, and I think that's what this film could have used a bit more of, is kind of goofy, kind of gory deaths.
I expected that too.
I mean, you call your film Pumpkinhead. How the fuck am I supposed to take it seriously anyway? It doesn't sound like a goofy name.
Right.
Like, they're killing children. There's fugitives involved. They're going straight for the truth. But I think if this film could have been improved, it would have been if you had given Stan Winston to Peter Jackson to allow him to make a movie.
Mm.
But, yeah, that's just me.
There's one shot, the first time Pumpkinhead starts roughing up Steve and like drops him the first time. Like, he's got his arms folded. I could have sworn his arms got torn off. And then later he brings the corpse to the front door of the cabin and they're still there. I'm like, well, that is kind of a blown opportunity. I did really like the kill when Joel finally gets his. Pumpkinhead picks up the rifle. For a second, I'm like, oh my God, it can use guns.
Yes, and I thought the same thing too.
Yeah, he was going to do it because Joel shot him. He can use guns,
but he just kind of, yeah, he basically just jams it through him and impales him on it with, like, yeah. I'll take it. That was pretty good.
That's the best kill.
Meanwhile, later on, like, the cars are wrecked where they parked, where presumably other people park, because it's the eldest of the redneck kids who told Lance where to get to Haggis. Mm-hmm. But so he decides he's going to help out the last two teens, Chris and Tracy, Photo Girl, and young Clark Kent, because his family will let him in, and he feels kind of responsible for taking Ed Hardy to Haggis anyway.
Well, that's the parallel to the opening scene of the other guy trying to get in, and Lance Henriksen as a kid didn't help, but this kid is going to help and see what he can do.
Yeah.
And then he gives us a whole scene of exposition with the two characters we didn't fucking need.
Oh, yeah, right. Totally.
It's an hour and 8 minutes into the movie, and this kid's like, let me go over who Pumpkinhead is and what happened. And it's like, I just saw it for an hour.
Yeah, we figured it out by now.
To wrap up the exposition, they run off down this trail in the woods. Shot goes on for entirely, like, 40 seconds too long.
There's a lot of padding in this film, because it's a short film. It's only 90 minutes, I think, or 86 minutes.
Yeah.
But I would have preferred it to be a 22-minute, you know, like, episode of something, like an episode of Millennium that Homeboy was from.
Yeah.
That television series.
That could have worked.
Yeah, on Fox after or before the X-Files.
I like all the final scenes in the movie, though. The final fight between the two surviving teens and Lance Henriksen, which I called at the very beginning of the movie. I didn't mention earlier in the podcast, but I was like, oh, Chekhov's flamethrower. That's going to come back later. And it does. And that's where we get to realize that if you hurt Lance Henriksen, which you see happen a couple times earlier in the movie, so if you're intelligent enough, you've already put together that if you hurt him, you hurt Pumpkinhead too, because they are connected.
Yeah. Physically and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
That's where there's a lot of cool makeup things with, like, Lance Henriksen's eyes, and, you know, that's where we get the cool transfer where Pumpkinhead's face turns into, like, a Lance Henriksen Pumpkinhead, and that looks really good. Stan Winston shining through in that moment.
Well, I didn't finish with the whole dirt bike thing. Like, the dirt bike's left, and young Clark Kent jumps on it, starts revving it, and then Pumpkinhead just pops up. Apparently, he was able to pop the chain off, like, without it looking like too much damage, even after he couldn't shoot the gun, which kind of bugged the shit out of me. But I do love that he just then throws the bike. Actually, the whole, like, Chris dead, not dead sequence was kind of good, even though it was too late to start padding it out like that. Because, like, he throws the bike, and Chris isn't dead. Bunt, the kid, and Tracy haul off to try and find somewhere else to hide, and then run right into Lance Henriksen, who is like, all right, I'm going to redeem myself, and I'll haul you two off, even though, well, they don't know he's responsible for it yet. Well, they kind of do. That's right. Bunt did kind of reveal it by that point. But then Chris gets dragged off by Pumpkinhead, who gets distracted for a minute and then drops him. He tries to crawl away, and then Pumpkinhead steps on the back of his head, and you're like, okay, is he dead now? No. Yeah, like I like the idea of that, but it was kind of clumsily edited. It's really weird. Like, the whole movie keeps bouncing back and forth between good editing moves, great editing moves, and then just this bullshit. And I'm still mad about the opening montage with the teens. That was terrible.
A lot of time was wasted there. We are running a little long, so I do want to wrap it up. Basically, the reveal, yes, is that Ed Harley is connected to this monster, and Ed Harley will either die once the monster is done exacting revenge, or needs to die to kill this monster, or if the monster is killed, it kills Ed Harley. This is the big trade-off. The big reveal at the end is the person who summoned or requested the summoning of Pumpkinhead, who's connected to the monster, now becomes the corpse that's buried into this Pumpkin Patch graveyard, which is not said. It's not called the Pumpkin Patch graveyard until the earlier scene with Bunt, who's telling them about the Pumpkin Patch graveyard. Why that couldn't have been said during the witch scene, I don't fucking know. I didn't write this shit.
Oh, I missed that bit. That's why
he finally calls it a Pumpkin Patch graveyard. Okay, well, cool. But at that point, too little, too late. Like, I knew it was a Pumpkin Patch graveyard because I was like, why are there fucking pumpkins in this graveyard patch?
Well, they wanted to establish some mystery with that. I think that was an okay narrative call.
I guess. I would have preferred one or the other. Call it a Pumpkin Patch graveyard, right? Or don't call it that, and there's just pumpkins there. Like I said, I feel like it was an outline that never really came together. I agree with John that it wasn't as gory as I expected it to be, especially for the era of which it came out, where everything was slasher and gore. I did like the maliciousness of the monster, but it just, nothing was full force. It felt like it was just thrown together, and it was too clumsy for me. Let's go through final thoughts on the film. John, let's start with you.
Okay. I'm sure you can tell how enthusiastic I am about it from that side.
John begrudgingly is on the call because he's like, look, I watched it, so I might as well stay on the phone.
John would rather be playing the Bishop knife game right now.
That'd be another recycling of a piece of Alien's corpse, wouldn't it? This film, for me, I was a big horror movie fan as a child and a teenager. And I'm still a horror movie fan, obviously, but this film always had a reputation of being one of the C-grade horror movies. And watching it today, admittedly, I watched it on a very bright and sunny Sunday afternoon, but it lived up to that reputation of not being of the highest quality. I think the ideas in the film are actually pretty interesting. And when it caught me, not necessarily the monster stuff, but the idea of teenagers or young adults accidentally killing a child or getting involved in a really bad mistake like that, that kind of caught me off guard. And I was like, whoa, okay. I expected it to follow down that road, but the execution of that idea just wasn't of the highest quality as far as I was concerned. I think there was a lot more interesting things you could do with it. If anyone would be interested in seeing a film that uses similar themes in a completely different way, I'd recommend checking out The Machinist, the film with Christian Bale,
where he gets
all skinny. Uses similar ideas to Pumpkinhead, but way, way better.
I like that pull. That's a good pull, John.
Yeah. It commits the worst sin of any horror movie. It gets boring at times. And it just didn't do it for me. I didn't hate it. As I said, there were things that I like. Lance Henriksen as a person. He seems like an all right guy. He's been in some good movies, but didn't really tick any boxes for me.
Yeah. Keith?
I think it's all right. It's not the worst. It could have easily be fixed, as you mentioned, by making it more ambiguous. You know, why not have the whole open... I say, do a longer opening with Lance Henriksen as a kid, where he learns more about Pumpkinhead, building up to that first scene of the guy, you know, banging on the door and blah, 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 blah. And then rather than having Haggis show up, he remembers all this in the stories and what to do and goes, buries his son in the pumpkin patch, as you mentioned. The son comes back as the monster, and now we have the conflict of him having to kill this creature that is his son. And maybe he buries the son with the necklace, and his final realization that it's the son as he sees the necklace on the monster, rather than the ending of, is Ed Harley the new Pumpkinhead? Is that how it works? When you kill them, the one burns and dies, and then the other one morphs into it, and Haggis comes and buries you because it had the necklace the sun had given him. I don't know. I think it's not bad, you know. I sat down with, like, a bunch of wings and French fries and had some ice cream and watched this, and it wasn't the worst. But there's definitely superior films you can watch to Pumpkinhead. Who knows? Maybe Pumpkinhead 2 Blood Wings is a lot better than this.
Hmm. Chris?
Mostly made it clear already, and I agree with Capcom. It's mostly a mess execution-wise. It's all over the place. It's a very... It was Stan Winston's directorial debut, so it's a very effects guy directing other effects guys, because all the effects stuff looks great, but the structure, sloppy, the storytelling, kind of sloppy. That ending scene, I thought was trash. Just, it's like one or two, maybe three shots in that yard, like three different angles, and it's just boring to me, the showdown. I did love that flamethrower does nothing, even though the flamethrower was the Chekhov's gun from the opening scene, does nothing, and then the thing bursts into flames anyway. I did kind of love that. But again, I like the idea of it. I like, you know, he has to kill himself, and that even doesn't quite entirely work until everybody's shooting Lance Henriksen. Happy shoot Lance Henriksen day, everybody. I do like the idea of a cyclical nature of the Pumpkinhead, like the previous connected person becomes an because that sets it up for sequels, obviously.
Right.
Or at least an extended lore and why this thing would keep coming back X number of years between incidents that people need it. Could have used a lot of work, but I didn't think it was that bad. It was what I expected going into it, and it's a good time. And again, a lot of great special effects work if you're into that. And that if you get the collector's edition DVD, and I guess it's on Blu-ray at this point, that's all they could get for the commentary is like a couple of the special effects guys and a fan of the movie to moderate. So that's what they're going to be talking about. But it is worth a listen if you enjoy the first run through. Worse things have happened, but if you want a better scene with a guy named Chris crawling on the ground and some dude with basically the same flamethrower, go play Until Dawn on the PlayStation 4.
All right. Nice recommendation. Hey, if you enjoyed our banter and you want to keep listening to us review games, we do it weekly. Please visit us at WeTalkGames.com. And Keith, where can listeners find out more about the 8-Bit Horror Fest Origins, which I have to assume if they're listening right now to this, they already know. But let's remind people anyway.
Well, you should make sure you check out the 8-Bit Geek at the 8BitGeek.com. You can follow them on Twitter at the 8-Bit Geek. And they record Monday nights for our Eastern Sea folk, Eastern Seaboard people. I know.
Seaboard people?
We're on the eastern side of the ship that is the United States.
Is this a fucking Scientology podcast?
I don't know what's going on. On the Eastern Coast in Eastern time zones. It's at 9 p.m. every Monday night. They record live on Twitch. Twitch.tv/.
Get clear of your fucking Thetans, evidently.
Yeah, I think it's twitch.tv/8BitGeek or the 8BitGeek. I'm not sure. I'm subscribed, so it just pops up. They also have a Patreon. Go donate, and you get a lot of cool bonus stuff. They're really awesome guys over there. They've been big supporters of us. So
hey, they've
been on our show. Yeah, they've been on our show for the. Stinky brought him back because he didn't realize he hired them last year and fired them. So I think they got fired again this year. So go check out our Summer of Stink for 8-Bit Geek reviewing Lager?
Lager, yeah. And Kevin was on our Dungeons & Dragons episodes. If you like arcade games and you like old games, check out WeTalkGames.com/InTheCan, and you can search and see if we talked about your favorite arcade game.
I think Kevin actually premiered on an episode with me here on We Talk Games, originally when I first started. So look that up at WeTalkGames.com/InTheCan.
All right, I got the flashing red light. We have to wrap it up, and something just came over my spooky facts. Let's see this. We're going to toss on over to Count Flagula and manservant Ugor. But before we do that, I want to thank everyone for listening for John E. Capcom, Chris Nicobun, and Keith the Robo Duke. Man, it's a stacked show this week. I'm Kyle Von Kubik. Thanks very much for listening. Please check us out and keep enjoying this year's 8-Bit Horror Fest. On over to you, Count Flagula.
Thank you, my fellow We Talk Game staff.
I am Count Flagula, on account of our light flags. Here again with my trusty manservant, the deaf-mute robot caveman, Ugor. Well, did the boys get it right or did they get it wrong? I think they got it right for their generation. But imagine, if you will, coming out of your teens, moving out of your home for the first time, and being a fan of motorcycles and horror movies. Indeed, the review may have been different, but we'll never know, because that's how time works. To the future, and more of the future. Ugor was just telling me a joke about infinity, but he couldn't remember how it ended. I am Count Flagula, on account of I like flags a lot. And we are once again gracious to the 8-Bit Geek to allow us to review another 8-Bit movie for their 8-Bit Horror Fest. I am Count Flagula, on account of I like flags. And this is my trusty manservant, the deaf-mute robot caveman, Ugor. And we hope you enjoy the rest of 8-Bit Horror Fest. Tune in again next week as the 8-Bit Horror Fest continues. And I'll see you. Well, I'll see you on the Switch, and then I'll also see you in the grave. I almost started singing a song there. I'm Count Flagula, on account of I like flags. I hope that you like us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Oh.